This is the Weekend Wake Up with Chuck Bonnewell and Julie Hayden on News Talk 710 KNUS.
All right, we're back, and we're thrilled to have with us Larry Ambrose. He's the president of Inter-Neighborhood Cooperation, or INC, which is kind of an umbrella group for most of the registered neighborhood organizations in Denver. And that may not, you know, they may be obscure to you, but Larry and INC have become almost a government in exile.
That's true.
In regard to the Denver City Council. I mean, luckily, we've got three, and Larry tells us me four, but three anyway, city councilmen who are not just come along to go along. They fought the real estate developers and won incredible elections with the help of people like Larry.
Call them citizens.
Citizens, yeah, real citizens. And it really is amazing how much people, if you're in one of those districts representing that is owned by the mayor, you might as well not go to city council. If you have a gripe, you know, going to your city council member, he won't pay any attention. Certainly if you go before him at a city council meeting, they could care less. So a lot of people go to INC, and one of the examples of that is this Denver Zoo fight.
The incinerator.
They're going to build a massive incinerator, which was sort of crazy. A lot of good, bright people went to city council. City council, it was unanimous, Larry?
It was a 13-zip vote.
Right, and you know it's bad when it's 13-0. You know it's bad. But they came to INC, and INC issued a resolution or a letter, and that riled up the Denver Post enough. They wrote this massive editorial saying that, you know, this is a kind of project that really, you know, is a legacy one that we all ought to follow. That, what are these stupid citizens? What are they doing protesting all of this? 2 weeks later, they admitted the citizens are right. This is an unproven technology. It didn't work. And all the Denver Post could say in the sub-editorial is, what a mess. Well, you made the mess. Thank you, guys. Well, welcome to the program, Larry.
Thank you, Larry, and welcome to the program. We were at the Zoo News Conference, and I was sitting next to, it was not the Denver Post reporter. Their environmental guy had done a lot of good reporting on it, and this was a different reporter, and I apologize, I don't remember his name, but he actually said to me, I couldn't believe this, he said, well, there are only 20 people against the incinerator. And I thought, first of all, I thought, what a ridiculous thing for a reporter to say, as if they've done some sort of survey somewhere, and there's an actual hard number, you know, because I wanted to say, well, I'm against it, so that makes 21, you know what I mean? It was a silly thing, but that was sort of the attitude there about, once, you know, oh, silly citizens, you know?
Well, Larry, why don't we start off, what exactly is INC, and how did you become the head of it?
Well, INC is basically the Association of the Registered Neighborhood Organizations in Denver. Denver has a system where neighborhood organizations, if you have 12 members get together, you can register with the city to be recognized as an RNO, Registered Neighborhood Organization. And that gives you certain privileges to receive notice about city ordinances and from city agencies. It also gives you some kind of standing to go before city council and to be heard.
Not listened to necessarily.
No, just to be heard. It's just they're beginning to understand that when people speak, they should also listen. But the registered neighborhood organizations, there's about, the way it's set up, a business improvement district, a homeowners association for a single building, or registered groups of residential-based homeowners, or, you know, individual homeowners, can become an RNO. So there's about 225 to 250 RNOs at any one particular time that register with the city. Of those, we estimate about 125 to 150 are actual neighborhood groups that stand for maybe as many as 25 to 4,000 homes.
Right.
In different neighborhoods. So you get together, you form these groups, and then of those, Inter-Neighborhood Cooperation has about 100 that belong to our organization at any one time. And we get together once a month. Each organization has two delegates. We have different committees that operate. We have a zoning and planning committee. We have a parks and recreation committee, a transportation committee, education committee, public safety committee. And they operate to address these city issues and then to take positions and to advocate on behalf of the neighborhoods with the idea that, you know, that we are empowering people and that people in the neighborhoods will have a voice.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, you'd think that would be
your council person.
Your council person. But, you know, we were talking about off air the fact that, you know, it used to be, and I guess used to be was in the 90s, early 90s, and for 100 years before that, that it was a real legislative branch. People argued, people you know, took on the mayor on different ones, and that all disappeared. I mean, other than Charlie Brown would occasionally take on the mayor and Ginny Fonts would. But other than that, they just go along to get along folks, and it stopped being a debating society. It didn't matter. I mean, they'd have hundreds of people show up for some of these development ones, and you know, it, nothing they said was listened to. Nothing. It was shocking, really.
You know, we have a nonpartisan form of government.
Right.
Remember, it cuts both ways. It's kind of a double-edged sword. In one way, it's very good because most municipal issues, 99% are
nonpartisan. Right.
A pothole isn't red or blue.
Right.
Or
right.
Purple. On the other hand, the political parties serve a purpose at the state and national level in that they vet candidates, they take positions on issues, they have platforms, and they hold their representatives, the people that they choose to go into elected office, accountable.
Right.
They demand transparency and they demand accountability. We don't have that at the municipal level, and most people at the municipal level, at city politics, are probably the last thing that people think about.
And I think it should be the first, really, because it's what affects you the
most.
It
should be the first, but people think of national, state, and then local.
Yeah, sure. And part of the problem, and we're is the fact we're a one newspaper town now. And
yes.
And one of the councilmen you were talking about, who had gotten off the council, but he said, you know, Well, I'll let you tell. What did he tell you about, you know, the famous mosquito and all that? Because Julie will enjoy this. Why don't you tell him what he told you?
Well, when we lost our newspaper, I'd gone to visit Doug Linkart, and we were talking about accountability, and I think it had to do with the History Museum going into Civic Center Park
right.
at that time, because Mayor Hickenlooper wanted to build the museum right in the middle of Civic Center Park. And I told him that we were going to fight that. And he said, well, you're going to have a hard time because, you know, we don't have any newspapers anymore. And we can pretty much, we as council people can do what we want.
Right.
He said, you know, we still have the television stations. but, you know, a reporter comes and talks to us and maybe they do a little episode on that. But it's kind of like a mosquito bite.
Oh, God.
They just bite and it goes away.
I shouldn't laugh, but it's, you know, and that is so true. But it's very difficult to get local TV stations to cover city, community, you know, politics. And for the life of me, I don't know why. Because Chuck's paper does it, and people love Chuck's paper because they're seen as sticking up for the, you know, even at Fox 31, we'll call ourselves problem solvers. And if you've got a whiny complaint about a contractor, we'll call the contractor for you. But you've got, like, neighborhoods being destroyed, and it's like, and I don't know, I don't understand why we don't cover those more. And my own personal theory is that the industry doesn't pay very much anymore. So you've got, I mean, you know, the average producer putting together a show is like 27. I mean, we've got 23-year-old reporters in town, you know, and I think people just come and go, and there's no sense of history of, or they don't care, I guess, maybe is the bottom line.
Well, the council people, you see, it's easier. They get elected once every 4 years. And so every 4 years they become a Democrat
mm-hmm.
or a Republican or an independent, and they all of a sudden are at the political party meetings. But in between, there's really nobody who holds their feet to the fire. There's,
right.
And so that's the purpose of the neighborhood movement in my
right.
mind, is that we serve the purpose of
the watchdog,
of accountability and transparency. We ask for that of our council people. And then getting back to what you said about how the reporter said that, well, there are only 20 people opposed to this. You know, we hear that all the time about neighborhood groups. Well,
sure.
You're really just a group of 25
right.
people, or you're just, you know, you don't represent what all the people think.
All the people want an incinerator at the zoo.
But the fact is that people who care enough to get involved in this stuff, who study the issues, they're the people who are the opinion leaders. They're
right.
the ones who take the lead, and we hope that by doing that, other people hear us and pay attention
well,
to
for
it,
instance,
and they can disagree if they want, and they can also join the movement. But it's easier for city council to just be able to sit back and say, you don't represent us. First of all, it's true that most neighborhood groups are not as diverse as is our city, but the people, and mostly older people, because they're the people who have the time to take to actually do this. Other people are out raising families and working.
Well, if you live at the poverty level, it's not really, you don't really, you have to worry about bringing food on the table, and municipal issues don't mean as much, just logically.
Well, and let me ask you this, because I've become a conspiracy nut lately. What I see happening in Denver with all of these apartments, the city has realized to a certain extent, and by the city, I guess, I mean the Hancock administration and some city council members, that neighborhood organizations are pesky. They're pesky. You got to deal with them, and they're always calling you. But if you can bring in a bunch of millennials who don't even really know what their zip code is, and all they're doing is they're taking Uber to and from the nightclubs and the bars, then they don't care if there's a traffic issue. They don't care about the stuff that that property owners and people who have raised families and are raising families. And that's what I think anyway. It's like if they can just get rid of actual homeowners, you know, life is so much easier for a city.
I think in the long run that'll change, though. I mean,
right.
I don't see that the new people moving in are having a profound influence in supporting the mayor's
agenda. No, they don't
vote. Yeah, I mean, I think the people who still care are setting the trends. And over time, you know, to me, things are a bell-shaped curve.
Yeah.
You know, you've got the wackos on each end, and then you've got the people in the middle who really care and who really are going to set the trends. And people kind of come together to come up with the right solution. So over time, even the new people are going to be frustrated with traffic, or they're going to want to go to a park, and they're going to have some peace and quiet. All of the things that are important to quality of life are just as important to those folks as they are to the people who've been
that's true.
For the last 50 years.
Well, what about, you wanted to talk about the St. Anthony lawsuit. Why don't we kind of explain what we're talking about here?
Well, I guess we got to kind of go back to the 2010 when most people don't realize that the entire city was rezoned.
Blueprint Denver.
Well, it was the new zoning code, the
right.
Zoning Code Task Force, mm-hmm. which started about 2006 when Peter Park, who was then the planning director.
Ooh.
Chuck doesn't like planning directors.
I love planning directors that are planning directors. I don't like the ones, you know, I mean, Denver's a beautiful city, and to watch them destroy it is sad. I mean, it really is sad.
Yeah, we're losing our sense of place, aren't we?
Yeah.
You really are. And you know, you were talking one time where you got some, I forget it was, but and all it said was density, 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 density. And give us your Queens soundbite. Oh. I love this.
Well, the new zoning code in places rezoned Denver in ways that I don't think anybody imagined. I mean, it's so dense. And it's resulting in what we're now seeing today. I don't think people realize that their properties were rezoned.
Oh, yeah.
It was a long process, and there were a lot of people involved, but it was pretty much a one-way process, and it was Peter Park's vision, it was the city's vision.
And you know, having been part of local government and then everything else, that's always the way it works. When Dan Ritchie is going out today on a listening tour through Colorado, he's not doing a listening tour. He's already got exactly what he wants to do to us, you know, for his own personal benefit. And they'll pretend they're doing it. And when people say, okay, we're going to open up the process, they already know exactly what they want to do. And then they kind of go, well, you all.
There's only 20 of you.
Well, no, they says, you know, this, we've organized this, and it's amazing. You all have told us to do what we wanted to do in the first place. I mean, and so when Peter Parks says, okay, it's an open process, he doesn't mean that, right? He means he's going to do what he wants to do. He wants to have the facade of it, and he'll pretend that the ideas were developed out of that. And there never are. They're always developed ahead of time.
It's a very controlled process, and they present it to you and say, okay, now you can tweak it. You know, here it is. Don't change it, but you maybe
we'll
let you tweak it.
If you're lucky.
Yeah. So anyway, this zoning code resulted in what we're seeing today, and it's incredible changes to neighborhoods of stability. See, right. We have what's called Blueprint Denver, which is divides the city into areas of stability and areas of change.
Right.
So the change was supposed to take place in areas of change. And areas of stability, though, are now areas of change. And areas of change are unlimited.
Well, and
you can change and change again. Change again.
Well, and part of the issue is to use, rather than sort of the politically correct terms, is there are certain places that developers want to develop. And they don't want to develop for reasons that really you can understand if you're a developer in, you know, Globeville and Swansea. They want to develop in Cherry Creek North. And so that
Wash Park,
Wash Park. So those are the stable areas, but there are the desirable. Yeah. And the city's letting them do that as opposed to.
Well, they would go over to Swansea and Globeville and they, or at least other areas if they were required to. And those areas would grow and they would prosper.
Right.
Because that's where they can build.
Income inequality would be, you know.
Yeah. You'd get more diversity of wealth in those neighborhoods and everything else. But if you allow them, they'll Hickenlooper, you know, I know where you are, the History Museum, right in the middle of the park. That'll do it. I love John Hickenlooper as mayor, but he was terrible for parks. He was a commercialization guy. How do we monetize this? And then every once in a while, plant some trees. There. Just plant some trees and then. He took one of the ones off Colorado Boulevard near Glendale and so forth and just shoved trees in it. It was a wonderful park before, but he wanted to plant lots of trees, so they just, there you go. Wow, I'm a green guy. And it was sad. And if he was bad, Michael Hancock, and he belongs to the National Mayor for Parks Commission. And what he means is the National Mayor is for destroying parks. Because anytime you're a city planner, and I've been a lot of them, you know, they look at a map and go, what's this green area?
They just don't get the unintended consequences of all this.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It just looks good on the surface. Look at that city loop.
Right
in City Park. I mean, it was outrageous. It just didn't fit. It looked ridiculous in the park, and they didn't even take into consideration the parking impacts on the neighborhoods.
Oh, they never do.
Things like that.
That's what's happened
with the zoning code. We have all these unintended consequences, and we have a city now. You know, we used to be called the Queen City of the Plains. Now we're more like a city on the plains, like Queens.
Yeah. I love that.
A little dense. Well, let's talk, like I said, I wanted to get you to explain this, and we're talking about the St. Anthony. It's a lawsuit you guys have filed, but it's the development where St. Anthony's used to be there off of, like, it's by Sloan Lake, kind of, right?
Yes, it's the area between Perry Street and Stewart Street and between Colfax and 17th Avenue, right on the lake. And it was an area that we knew was going to change. It was an area of change. Back in 2006, Centura Health and St. Anthony's announced they were leaving Denver and moving to Lakewood. And so that became ripe for development. And a task force was formed. Hickenlooper actually appointed people from the neighborhoods, from businesses. It was a combined effort of the city and the Centura Health and the neighborhoods, and we had about 100 people participate in a process that kind of visualized what that should be. And it was dense. It was actually visualized to be 800 to 1,200 people in what we're talking about there is about a 12-square-block area. But it was shaped. What the task force did is they came up with the idea that it would be like a pyramid, kind of, so that the tallest buildings would be back towards Colfax, and the park would kind of come across 17th Avenue, and it would scale up from there so that people would have views. I mean, it's one of the most incredible sites for views because you can look out at the lake, you can look at the mountains to the west,
downtown.
To the north,
mm-hmm.
You can look at downtown. And so if you shape the buildings in a way away from the park, and of course the people in the neighborhoods didn't want the tall buildings right on the park, right on 17th Avenue. We wanted it to transition up towards Colfax. So that was the vision, and that's what was put into this task force report back in 2006. At the same time, there was we have a process called small area plans in Denver, where people get together in their neighborhoods and they decide what the future of development is supposed to look like. And the small area plan in that area was called the West Colfax Plan, and it was taking place contemporaneously with the St. Anthony's plan. And so instead of the West Colfax Plan group planning the St. Anthony's, they said, we're just going to incorporate the guiding principles from the St. mm-hmm. Anthony's report right. into our plan, which is what they did. So that became part of the West Colfax plan, which then goes to City Council and becomes an ordinance. So that plan, the West Colfax plan, is an adopted ordinance, an adopted plan, and becomes part of what's called the comprehensive plan,
right.
which is Blueprint Denver.
Right.
And according to the zoning code, even the new zoning code, the city is supposed to follow those plans, as is City Council in any new rezoning. But when the developer came along in this process in 2011, it's a company called EFG, yeah. Enviro Finance Group.
Ooh. You know, right you there. Know. That is a bunch of evil people.
Because all of those Enviro Finance people,
oh, man.
We have to take a break, but okay. I'm just going to bet when we come back, you're going to tell us
that Enviro
the first thing they said is we are going to implement the citizen vision.
Yeah, with building everything right next to the lake and by the park.
And we're going to make them a little taller than y'all thought you. We'll be right back after this. We're talking to Larry Ambrose, sort of the chief neighborhood guru in Denver.
All right, we're back here with Larry Ambrose. He heads up Inc., which, if you don't know, really is kind of like the shadow government. They have their own committees, and they're more representative, quite frankly, than a lot of council members are bought and paid for. But it's great. We're talking about the St. Anthony's development, and it isn't just St.
Anthony's.
It's over
there on, like, West Colfax.
Well, it's near Sloan's Lake.
Right.
Everybody's been by Sloan's Lake. But and this story is repeated time and time and time again, different characters, but the same hideous results. So
when we went to the break, you were telling us about how there'd been this lengthy process, inclusive process, and the city council actually passed an ordinance to implement what everybody agreed on was the vision for this development. But then what happened? What's the rest of the story?
2011, Enviro Finance Group comes in and buys the property.
Enviro Finance Group, that's my favorite name now.
It's a
kind of
Delaware
green.
They claim to be a Denver company. They came to Denver in 2009 and did the Dahlia Square Shopping Center. They got a lot of money from Dura, I think $11 million to do that. Not sure what they did. They took out a little dirt or something.
I think they took out a curb kind of thing. So.
And then they moved on to the Asarco site in Globeville, where they got $36 million to mix molasses with the dirt to mitigate the pollution there, which was
a
super fun
site. It.
And then they came over to Sloan's Lake to do the project in 2011. They hired a guy named Cameron Bertrand from Dura. He had been a Dura employee who was the guy who had given them the $11 million
as long as you pay him afterward, it's okay in our country. You know, in Mexico, they would have paid him beforehand, but here we just pay him after.
And then he also gave him $36 million for Asarco. Then he got hired as their vice president. He came to the neighborhood group.
I'm shocked.
Came to our neighborhood group and said, we're going to do this. And we said, look, we'll get along fine. Just don't put the tall buildings next to the park on 17th. Put them back towards Colfax. Of course, they ignored that. Over a period of 3 years in the planning process, they insisted upon putting the tallest buildings right on 17th. That's what this is all about. It's pretty simple. I mean, you can understand the want for people to live, to have lakefront property,
right.
But it is contrary to the plan and contrary to the best interests of the neighborhood, and we don't want tall buildings all around Sloan's Lake. We are not Central Park. We're not New York. And we have high rises in the neighborhood from place to place, but they should be placed appropriately.
They should be.
So that's what the suit is about. And then how EFG managed to get the city to go along, and how the city went along and just came along with EFG, and then
we fought it and
didn't do any good.
One of my favorite characters this week called Beefy, Bloated, Ethically Challenged Brad Buchanan. He was on the planning board. Then, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, then he joined this wonderful thing as a paid consultant.
Well, it was his firm that actually was hired as the architects by EFG.
Which was smart, right?
But he was with R&L. He was
R&L,
the principal in R&L.
So he got bought off, and then he became the executive director. And I think there's an ethics complaint, although ethics complaints in Colorado go to the ethics board, who has never found that there's ever been an ethical violation in the history of Denver. But he actually, everybody said, that's fine. You can go from being a planning board member, then be their consultant, and then be executive director, and there's never a conflict?
No, and in fact, in late June of 2013, when the first public meeting for the general development plan for this project was presented to the public, we have there's a process that Brad himself engineered as part of the new zoning code, because he was instrumental in the new zoning code as head of the planning board.
I bet he was.
So he passed the new zoning code, put this general development plan process in place. And what it is it comes before the zoning. General development plans used to be an instrument, kind of a technical document that was like a site plan. How tall the buildings were going to be within a zone district, how much open space, but it was based on the zoning. So what the new code does was put the GDP before the zoning process, so that the developer comes in and says, okay, we're going to build 20-story buildings, we're going to have, a little postage stamp of open space.
And then you zone it to make that happen.
And then after that, they go to city council and say, here, we've already got this plan. Now you have to change the zoning based on the plan.
Right.
And they actually, in this particular case, in the St. Anthony's case, called it an adopted plan. An adopted plan.
Adopted plan.
It's not adopted. It was passed by the planning board, not the city council.
And what I love about Brad Buchanan, he is a beefy, bloated guy, but he lives in a 1,500 acre ranch, right, in eastern Colorado.
Not that dense out there.
Not that. And all he ever talks about is density. We need more density. Who's we, Kemosabe? What's the we part of this? why don't we build a nice apartment house on your ranch?
Well, and where the thing is if you live in Denver and you buy property in Denver, and you may have a house sitting here, and if you've done your homework, you can look at the zoning code and you can say, oh, okay, I see, well, this is zoned a park or open space, and this is zoned, single or two-level houses. It's meaningless, essentially.
Right.
You have a nice church. This is a nice church. Great, I'd love to live next to a church. Everybody now has got little vulture funds to buy up church property on parks, because then you just build a huge apartment house there. It's amazing process.
Well, it just seems that whatever you have, you can get 25% to 50% more, if not more than that.
Well, shoot, what we're going to all turn into now are giant, greenhouses for marijuana grow operations, too. That's the next big thing. Well, let me ask you, because Aaron had called earlier and asked us about the stock show. Just as head of the neighborhood of Inc., what's your take on the stock show vote that people are deciding right now in Denver?
Well, we had a forum. Keep in mind that Inc. does not take positions on ballot issues, because we're a 501c3. We do resolutions on issues before council that they can take to the vote. But in regards to what was pointed out at the forum that we did on the stock show, I think some of the salient points are that it is a tax into perpetuity, although it could be changed by city council. And there was some discussion about whether or not they shouldn't have divided the stock show issue from the convention center issue. Why they're combined is kind of a puzzlement to a lot of people.
And is there, and I understand you're not taking a position, but just, and you may not know the answer there, but is there any kind of guarantee that the money goes?
Because I wanted this for Aaron. Could you give us your personal opinion, separated from Inc., it has nothing to do with Inc., about what you think of the proposal?
I'm worried about the neighborhoods. I think that this kind of massive development without a promise from the city first as to what's going to happen and how the neighborhoods will be involved, an actual putting in writing. I've seen it happen too many times before. People are hoping it'll be good for the neighborhoods, but
it never is.
But it'll be gentrified and people who are there will be displaced. We still haven't resolved completely the issue of I-70 and the width of it and how that's going to impact.
Although the Department of Transportation thinks they've resolved it, essentially.
Well, they think. But essentially, some people described it as a $1 billion honeypot for a corrupt mayor. I think that's probably a fairly accurate description. But let's take a call.
It is an awful lot of money without a budget.
Well, it's not a budget.
Or a plan. They don't even have a vision,
it tends to drift off into people's pockets real quickly. let's take a call from Robert, who wants to talk about Glouville. Welcome, Robert.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Very interesting discussion. I was born and raised in Glouville. Not there anymore, but my church is still there. just wondering what seems to be the future of Cloquetville.
It's going to be an interstate, I think.
Well, the Asarco site, as I mentioned before, it was a Superfund site. I don't know if anybody knows where it is. It's actually along Washington.
Up there in Washington, right?
Yeah, and if you actually stood on it, it's one of the most amazing views of the mountains and downtown, and it has it had a huge potential for development, especially residential development, if it had been cleaned up properly.
Right.
But unfortunately, this 36, it would have cost maybe 50 to 80 million to clean it up. There was a railroad track that ran right to the site. They could have taken all the dirt that was that had heavy metals and arsenic and all kinds of bad stuff and shipped it out of there. But instead, as I said, they chose this molasses that they mix with the dirt somehow eats up the organics and then puts it in place. But it doesn't address the heavy metals, so the site is only maybe 30% cleaned up. Therefore, there's a lot of stuff.
Right.
And they're going to pave it over and make it into a truck stop. So
there you go.
So part of the reason I think that maybe the mayor doesn't want to get rid of I-70 through there is because there's a plan for a truck stop that Trammell Crow is the developer of that, which is not Trammell Crow Residential, that's doing a lot of the stuff at St. Anthony's, but the real Trammell Crow is involved in that, and that's also very big. So a big part of Cloquetville now is going to be a truck stop.
Where's that truck stop going to be?
It's a pretty big truck stop, yeah.
The Asarco site.
So they're off of Washington, essentially, in I-70.
It won't be just a truck stop.
All right, hey, everyone. We're back here at Resurrection Village. There's cops rolling in. We're going to go up to the gate right now.
It never is. I mean, that's what they did with Lowry Vista. They said the city sold it to another one called Environmental Developers. And if it's got environmental,
then
you know they're sleazeballs. Let me finish this one, and let me get you back, Robert. And what they did, they said, okay, it can't be used as open space. It can't be, and you go, why not? Well, it's just so polluted. What's the solution? We'll just pave over everything, and that'll hold the, now it's opened up. And so it sounds like the same with the truck stop. But you were saying, Robert, sorry to interrupt you.
Right. I'm sorry for interrupting. On the one side, they're planning this big stock show renovation, and then behind over there where Denver Post used to be, they're planning some kind of big deal. I don't know if it's light rail or big commercial development.
I don't know if it's going to be. I can admit I don't know, but I think all the light rail stuff is kind of done. What they're doing light rail wise, I'm not sure. Larry knows.
Yeah, they did a plan. Kelly Lead, who was part of the Hensel Park planning project, moved over from from the mayor to doing that to conduct the Northwest Cornerstone project. And they did come up with some neighborhood involvement for kind of a vision for the Stock Show area. It includes parks. It includes a campus for CSU. There's some pretty good stuff in it. They are planning an event park, which I called 4 years ago, a festival park. Although I believe it should be closer to downtown, they want to put it there. And I'm not sure, I don't believe that it would really work there because they're planning on having the Stock Show pens, where the cattle are during the Stock Show, and then concerts in the summertime.
Right.
So I don't know where they're going to put this. The holes in the ground for the pens and, maybe a great pogo stick park where people could fall in these holes. But at any rate, there's all kinds of things that they got planned there, including some new parkland and revitalization of the river. But as again, it's not very specific in terms of budget and how it's really going to work. It's more of a grand vision. So if they do get this money, let's hope that people can get involved and get some promises.
Yeah, the people
city.
In Cloquetville deserve that. Hey, Robert, thank you for the call. We have to
appreciate
take a break. They've got to do something about the river. We just did a story about that marathon ran down along the river there, and people complained about the smell.
You got the sewage treatment plant.
Exactly. We're talking to Larry Ambrose, the president of Inc. Denver Neighborhood Organization, sort of umbrella organization, and we'll be right back after this.
Back to News Talk 710's Weekend Wake Up. with Chuck Bonnewell and Julie Hayden.
All right, we're back with Larry Ambrose. He heads up something called Inter-Neighborhood Cooperation, or INC. It's the umbrella group for neighborhood organizations in Denver. And I can remember when INC was just somebody nice that you know, they gave out awards, but they never did anything worthwhile, particularly worthwhile. And you've taken it over, and it's become a real voice for the neighborhood.
That's because there was a time when your city council members were paying attention to what the citizens want.
I also think, you know, the old Lyndon Johnson saying that power is where power goes. I think Larry has made it into a vital organization that it didn't used to be, quite honestly.
Well, thank you very much.
And
it's
Larry also,
it's not just me. I mean, there's
a lot of other people. That's right. It takes a team. But Larry, I was looking at the returns for the mayoral election. You know, they had token opposition, and then there was Larry Ambrose with 2,000 to 3,000 write-in votes. I was just shocked by that. And I asked, you know, and Larry said, "I didn't run. I didn't do anything." But I can't. Apparently, Dave Felice got a little campaign going, and that's incredible.
Well, the first thing I knew about it was I started getting emails and messages on Facebook that people had voted for me.
Said, that's a good thing. You could have woken up and been mayor.
I guess Dave started it. It kind of took fire, and people, you know, when they got their ballots, that's when it happened, and they realized there wasn't really a choice.
Right, right.
Of people who were involved in city issues, heavily involved, and then they, you know, it kind of took off, and I kind of sat there and was amazed. But I guess I got about 6 or 7 times as many votes as anybody in Denver history as a write-in.
Which is great.
But yeah.
Yeah, well, and right now we're declaring the Chuck and Julie Show the official Larry Ambrose for mayor site. Honestly, the mayor should have to have real opposition. And if you can get 2,000 or 3,000 people voting right in, then you could give them a real, and it'd be good for the city. The city should not have somebody like Michael Hancock just coronated. He needs to be debate some. And who knows? I mean, you know, he might actually become a better mayor if he had to kind of justify some of the things he does.
Well, you know, I'm not going to put this on him personally. Uh-huh. I mean, I have had my run-ins with the mayor starting back in 2006. When I went before city council, he was not very courteous. But
didn't he hammer you out of order and refuse to let you speak?
He wouldn't let me talk. And hammered me. What is that? Gavelled me down.
Gavelled me, that's right. Gavelled you down.
But, you know, when you really look at the campaign contributions historically, going back, you know, who actually, you know, what law firms and lobbyists and where this money comes from and developers. And,
right.
You know, there's a cadre of money givers that have historically picked the mayor, and all going back to Federico, too. You know, it was Marvin Davis,
right,
and Mickey Miller who put
Federico
in. Well,
one could argue, why would an unopposed Mayor Hancock even need campaign contributions?
Well, he got plenty from
nobody had that's one of the reasons nobody ran, is he had $1.5 million. I think.
Well, he had all the money from CRL. He had all the money from Brownstein. And Dan Ritchie is also part of the criminal cabal that funds some of these awful candidates.
Yeah, so there's a lot of vested interests that are at play here.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not that it hasn't been historically the neighborhoods, although, you know, now that we have social media and people have a voice, and hopefully as individuals people will step up and take an interest in local politics.
Well, and I think, you know, what also happens is all you got to do is drive down the streets, you know, and you look at some of these new apartment buildings going in, and there's no, like, for instance, I work at Fox 31, and the one, it's like there's not, they don't even pretend to plant, there's not, you know, no even dandelions room to grow. It comes boom right to the sidewalk, and I think people,
it is shocking,
and you can't find a place to park, and it takes you forever to get anywhere anymore.
We went to the Restoration Hardware opening on Wednesday, the Cherry Creek Shopping Center.
Were you there? That was insane, the people who were there. I'm like, this is a department parking store. Wayne Gretzky was there.
Wayne Gretzky, everybody was there with their nieces. and it is amazing, though, that you know, it's right up to the street. I mean, you know, it's enough for a little sidewalk, and then it's
gone. I call these little units that are, what, 400, 300 to 450 square feet, I call them people coops.
Yeah.
People coops. And some of them are hermetically sealed.
Yeah.
They don't have balconies or windows that open.
No.
And I figured out why that is. You know, they say a lot of the people are coming here because of marijuana, right?
Oh.
But you can buy an ounce of marijuana, go in there, and just really
you don't ever have to come out. That's true.
And why do they always build these with you know, the colors that you usually see in elementary school, you know, bright green and yellow and
well, colors
red
that you know are not going to be good in another 5 years.
Another 5 weeks.
I mean, yeah, mustard.
But the worse the building is, the brighter the colors. It's amazing stuff.
Well, you were talking about back to the St. Anthony's project. I think one of the things that's good to know are sort of who are the people behind the whole project. So, like Chuck says, this group, what's the name?
EFG.
Yeah, the name itself is suspicious.
Enviro Financial, you just know.
Well, I did a little looking into it, and it was quite interesting. Although there's a fellow named Stuart Miner who is kind of the front man here in Denver.
Yeah.
And Cameron Bertrand, as I mentioned. Turns out that the CEO of Enviro Finance Group is a guy named Edward K. Alangian.
The Lehman Brothers, man.
He was the head of the Lehman Brothers mortgage department back in 2006 and 7, just before the crash. Now he's in my backyard.
And he lives in Castle Pines?
He lives here in Colorado. Nobody's ever seen him that I know of. He certainly didn't appear before city council.
Hey, well, you know, only when the full
Lehman
moon
Brothers
is out does he get from the...
Because they handled that whole mortgage thing so well.
Yes, he handled it very well. It was a good job done by him. Now, that is what we're kind of... And Denver is such a wonderful place, and it really is sad that the Brad Buchanans and the Michael Hancocks and the Steve Farbers, you just go down the list, are slowly destroying the city. And great groups like Inc. and Larry, you know, you bring out the positions, you take resolutions. You're not a political group, so you don't get involved in politics. But at least you bring the facts to people that they can decide themselves.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate being on here, and hopefully...
Well, we're going to have you back.
Yeah, we'll stay in touch. We'll see what's going to happen with the St. Anthony. The court's agreed to hear the lawsuit, so that's a step forward, right?
We just submitted an opening brief, and we're waiting for...
Who are your lawyers?
A fellow by the name of David Medina.
Okay.
Is the lead lawyer on this, and there's a team of, I think, 5 or 6 paralegals and lawyers.
And, well, you know, Karen was talking about lawyers, and I don't disagree, but... The people who take in these kind of lawsuits are mostly given their time.
Completely.
And they really ought to be thanked. So
I'm glad
they're having it. And so that time went fast.
Yeah, Larry, thank you for your time. Craig Silverman is up next.
He's